And welcome back. While a great deal is known about the human brain, it's clear that there is a great deal that we don't know. It's the subject of constant study. It's of major interest to two Washington University neurosurgeons at Barnes Jewish Hospital. They are Dr. Eric Luthart and Dr. Albert Kim. They host a podcast called Brain Coffee, in which they examine topics related to the brain and how it influences who we are and how we act. Drs. Luthart and Kim join us in studio. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a long time between engagements. We've talked before on separate occasions. But anyway, welcome back. Dr. Kim, let me begin with you. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do we know about the brain?
I would say as much as we know, especially in the last few years, it's still close to 1. We understand sort of the rudiments of things, and I'm sure Dr. Luthart also has thoughts about this, but it's really the tip of the iceberg kind of stuff.
It's so important, obviously, to us. You would think and certainly hope to know more than 1 out of 10. What do you think, Dr. Luthart?
Yeah, I'd put us at around 5%.
Yeah.
Well, this is certainly an issue then, because it is so important to everything that we do. Why is it, do you think, that we know so little?
Well, I think it's a fundamental function of complexity that if you look at the number of neurons in the brain and you multiply that by the number of connections between those neurons and they're all working together, it really starts to outpace the number of stars in the universe. I mean, that, again, it's at that scale. And so getting your arms around that is hard.
Yeah, I would agree. It's an information processing problem. And so, you know, when you just have these multiplications of neurons, connections, and you know, we don't even know how each connection works. That's just assuming on and off for each connection. So I agree it's an information problem.
Will we ever know?
Absolutely. We will. Yes,
yeah, definitely.
I think one of the interesting phenomena is that as we see Moore's law continue to kind of, you know, rise at an exponential level, our ability to manage information is exponentially increasing. And I think actually some of the breakthroughs in neuroscience have occurred in the past 10 years because our computational abilities are exploding.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a great example of that is somebody who was a professor here, Dr. Lichtman, mm-hmm. who is basically at the electron microscope level scanning through an entire mouse brain. Now, even a tiny 1 millimeter segment couldn't be fit on a you know, computer mm-hmm. before, but now they can go through the entire brain, try to figure out all the connections in that.
Well, speaking of things electronic in the brain, what about Elon Musk's idea about implanting electrical devices in the brain? I mean, this becomes even more complex.
Well, that's certainly a topic near and dear to my heart. I've been working on brain-computer interfaces for the last 10, 15 years.
And written books about it.
That's right, and I have a number of fiction novels about it as well. I think Elon Musk's interest, as also Mark Zuckerberg's interest, you know, Facebook is dedicating a lot of engineering talent to creating the thought helmet, is that people are starting to take this idea of connecting with your brain and changing it, augmenting it, seriously. It's really become a the next generation of how we interface with machines. So it's going to happen. And now whether it's on an Elon Musk timescale or it's 50 years away, it's just a matter of time.
I do have to say it is already happening. I mean, what Dr. Luthart's talking about is, augmentation of normal.
Yes.
But right now, you know, for people with Parkinsonism or tremor, things like that, we're
or
already
cochlear
putting
implants.
We're already putting things into the brain to try to help
to restore
these conditions.
Function.
Right.
And we've been working on brain-computer interfaces for the recovery of function of stroke that are already here today.
But that has implications that a lot of people would look at that and say, well, how far can this be taken, and can it be taken for something against the public good?
You know, I think that that's a very fair concern. Yeah. And I would say one of the best ways to predict the future is to look at the past. Yeah. And technology is continually coming closer and closer to humans. And if you would have said to somebody in the mid-80s, hey, let's imagine this future. Let's say that everybody's carrying around a computer that's really super powerful, that tracks exactly where you are. It monitors all the communications that you have with everybody else, and that corporations are controlling this information so that they know about every purchase you make and can predict your behavior. Would that be scary to you? And people would be like, no way that could happen. No way, no way. But here we are, and we live with that reality today.
It's in my pocket.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the iPhone.
And the benefits far outweigh these theoretical concerns, but most people live with that. And I think as we look forward to the future, as technology continues to get closer and closer and closer to us, and the benefits will kind of continually augment kind of the and outweigh the risk, the question will be, you know, should I do this? You know, the question will become, why not?
Yeah. Well, it is scary. I find it scary, the ability to look at something online and 5 minutes later go to another website and something that you were just looking at pops up. They're following you, folks.
Right.
It is sort of scary, but that is progress. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about what we know about the brain. What is the difference between, Dr. Kim, I'll start with you on this, between the young brain, the middle-aged brain, and the older brain? They do change over time. It does change over time, I assume.
So there are a few principles we can talk about. So one thing is you're born with way too many neurons, actually. You get rid of actually half of them during development. And so the idea that more is better is not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. So over time, as we develop as babies and young kids, we keep the good neurons, the ones that are connected to the right targets, so to speak. And so that sort of focuses your mind to be able to do certain computations. Now, with that wiring in place, you can change each connection. And that's where the younger people are probably better than the older people at learning things, because their critical periods, for instance, for perfect pitch and for vision and things like that, where that will be lost as you get older.
But the brain is still developing. And a person that's 15 years old does not have a fully developed brain, do they, Dr. Lutherbach?
You know, one could argue through our life our brain isn't fully developed. I mean, I think that, you know, this issue of plasticity is actually one that we spoke of frequently in actually one of our Brain Coffee podcasts, that, you know, what happens in midlife, you know, to your brain? And how does that relate? You know, and how does that relate to the experience of the midlife crisis? And one of the things we talked about was, are you kind of hitting this perfect storm where your plasticity is reduced enough that you can't adapt to the changing demands of your life?
Which a lot of people obviously are experiencing today.
That's right.
As you say, with the technology.
That's right.
And then we get to the older brain, where we're looking at such things as dementia, Alzheimer's, and things of that kind.
Correct. So, I mean, plasticity still exists at that time scale. Now, in the case of diseases like that, you lose a lot of that plasticity for sure, but you still retain some of that plasticity that you had even when you were little. It's just the amplitude of it is less. It's lower.
What do we mean when we're talking about plasticity?
So I guess you can think about it like a dance, like a choreographed dance. So if you have a connection from one neuron to the next, you have certain proteins and molecules that make that connection happen, okay, that connect those two neurons. You can increase the number of proteins that make that connection stronger, or you can decrease in the number of certain proteins that make that connection weaker. Mm-hmm. So you can change the nature of each of those connections. That, in a sense, is plasticity. It's a plastic connection.
And dynamic, in that it changes with life experiences and information. And and you were always wondering to alter those connections, because those connections represent the information in your brain.
Mm-hmm. Do we know, I mean, if we have this 1-5%, whatever it is, knowledge about the brain, what do we know about someone who is a sociopath, for instance, as opposed to someone who is good?
Yeah, people have looked at this, and there are functional imaging studies done on people, you know, out of prison. And things that they found, for instance, is that certain areas related to emotion and inhibition are somewhat stunted, meaning the areas of it's this little kind of almond-shaped nucleus in your brain called the amygdala, associated with kind of fear and emotional encoding and emotional connections with people, and basal frontal areas. These are the areas that inhibit your behavior. So these people have reduced emotional interactions with people, and they have reduced inhibitions for their behavior. And so, again, you put those two things together, you don't have as much of an emotional connection with people, you have no fear, and you have fewer inhibitions, so you will kind of go after things that you want or perceive that you want and break normative rules.
I mean, the interesting thing also about that is whether, you know, that is hardwired by your DNA versus something that's environmental. I think that's something that's ongoing investigation.
That's right.
Right? Super interesting.
Well, I think this notion of, you know, how much it's nature versus nurture, how much of kind of who you are and what you are is kind of set in stone by your genetics versus how much of it is kind of shaped by the environment early and later in life, I think it's an ongoing debate, and that's stuff that we've debated about.
Yeah, for sure.
The environment would have to have some significant influence, I would think. The way you've grown up, the way your parents treat you, the way other people treat you, that sort of thing.
It most certainly plays a role, but there are really interesting stories. As an example, if you people look at twin studies, people are genetically identical twins and separated at birth, and they can have phenomenally similar life trajectories and life experiences, they name their dog the same name, even though they literally lived, with different families under different environments. So hard to know.
It's interesting. I think what we perceive to be genetic is also changing because, often you think of genetic studies, you think of twin studies, family studies, but now it's become increasingly known, for instance, and this is a bit away from neuroscience, but that even, bacteria in your gut, which you'll share with your family, might be preparing you to have certain diseases and probably affecting your cognition and ability to be plastic in some ways.
It'll certainly affect your mood. The biome in your guts will affect kind of how you will secrete certain agents in your blood that actually affect whether you're depressed or not depressed.
Right. So that, once was thought to be genetic because it looks like you're related to your mother in this, this property, but actually maybe it's just the gut bacteria that's mediating.
And don't forget about epigenetics, where this is kind of how genes are modified through your life by kind of whether certain carbon groups are attached to them, which can turn genes off or on. And this is your life experience affecting your genome, which is then passed on to your family.
Right.
Well, I'm having a little difficulty grasping some of this stuff, and I want to go back to consciousness and behavior. Is the brain dictating that, or is it the our life experience, our environment again?
Oh yeah, no. Actually, we've talked about this on Brain Coffee. This is a great topic. I think it's interesting to think about definitions. What exactly are we talking about when we say consciousness? Mm-hmm. Is it self awareness? Is it some kind of interaction with the environment? What do you think?
What's interesting is how much of our consciousness is input coming in, meaning our senses, and how much of it is actually created by our brain. For instance, the world, and there's a lot of science that would support that more of the world that we experience is created by our brain than the input coming in through our senses.
Right.
Our brain really just predicts what's going to come in.
It's top down.
It's top down. The term we use is top down.
Design. Yeah. Right.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating subject, but a hard one for someone not in your field to really kind of get a hold of.
Something we talk about, for instance, in our video blog. So you can define consciousness as self-awareness, and you could talk about that. Another very simple way to put it, and I think we talked about this, is why don't we just break it up into sort of the simplest parts? You need to be able to sense the environment, integrate that information, and then respond to the environment. Is that enough to be consciousness? What do you think?
And well, we argue that maybe whether you're conscious or unconscious is too much of a binary term. It may be continuum. So, for instance, by that definition, a flea is conscious.
Exactly.
Right?
But then you can study it in, for instance, flies or worms other organisms.
Like because they take input in, they process it, and they have an output.
Right.
Now, at what point do we get to the notion of self-awareness, meaning that there's a recognition of I.
Right.
Now you could even argue, for instance, are dogs, cats, dolphins, because they certainly are aware enough to preserve themselves if there's a threat. And so, at what point does it achieve the human level of, and it's almost a kind of artistic, poetic thing where you have trouble getting your hands around the exact definition
of
what that means.
I mean, the dog probably doesn't know that it has a red dot on its forehead, for instance, when it looks in a mirror. So by that definition of awareness, it wouldn't be self-aware. But, of course it has some awareness and consciousness. You've had dogs, and I have a dog right now.
Yeah, and the interaction with them is a very much an emotional one.
Yeah, for sure.
But they've done studies with animals, chimps, for instance, and determined that they do have a self-awareness problem using mirrors and what have you.
That's right. Well, it's interesting is so do ravens. Ravens are actually smarter than chimpanzees, and they can actually kind of predict future behavior and do planning at a level greater than chimpanzees. So again, it really challenges your notions of personhood when you start to think, go down this road.
The raven. So Edgar Allan Poe was correct.
He was
saying
on it.
That we should be scared of ravens.
He's on point. Yes.
What animal has the brain closest to our human brain? Do you have any idea? I've heard pigs, for instance. may have a brain that is very similar to ours.
That's interesting. So pigs are interesting for a number of reasons. The size of many of their organs approach human proportions is one. Another is that we can, and you know, people have differing opinions about this, but we can take organs from, because the size is similar, from pigs and use them, for instance, you know, I don't know, a heart from a pig or other things.
Valves and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Although their brains are much smaller, and the wrinkling, gyrated, the technical term is how gyriform are they?
Squiggly, right.
Yeah, is not nearly as what a human is for a pig.
Right.
You start to get much closer, when it's a chimpanzee, or actually, when you look at kind of dolphins and orcas, they have very well gyrated brains.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that to learn more about the brain and such things as Alzheimer's, and we're hearing a lot about concussions in football players these days, why is it that people have to die before you can really get at the problem? I mean, with all this technology we're talking about,
I think progress is indeed being made.
Yeah.
Now, as far as kind of why do you need to die to kind of, for instance, I think what you're talking about is traumatic encephalopathy.
CTE, right. CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Where proteins are deposited into the brain with, repeated concussions that lead to a dementia. Well, it is an active area of investigation where technology is being created. Like, can we create tagged markers for these bad proteins that glom on into the brain and identify them earlier? Then the question becomes, what do you do about it? And again, at WashU, there's experts like David Holtzman who, for instance, are really creating antibodies to start to see if we can leach out or attack these proteins when they shouldn't be there.
But there's been a lag in the progress because primarily CTE is diagnosed through a biopsy. So you need a piece of someone's brain. So you're not going to usually do that to most people unless they're in extremis or they've died. So I think that's part of it. It's defined by, what you see on a slide. So again, like Dr. Luthart said, it'll be great to have these markers that are non-invasive of CTE, but we don't have that yet. I mean, the other outstanding question, quite frankly, is we don't know exactly what the exact correlation between the burden of CTE and then your sort of level of dementia is,
Yeah, and that's also true for Alzheimer's because you can have people who have, these different pathologic proteins have different names, beta amyloid or tau, but sometimes people can have high levels of burden of the protein on their brain, but be seemingly normal.
Perfectly normal, exactly. So that we need to understand that, obviously.
I'm obviously the layman here, but I ask that question because people undergo brain surgery and tumors are removed from the brain. You would think that, and they're alive, obviously, while this is happening. Why you can't do that with someone who has Alzheimer's, for instance?
So it's a good question, but I think the thing about a tumor is that it, generally speaking, is located in one region. Mm-hmm. And that gives you the ability to do the surgeries that we do or treat it with the radiation. Whereas with things like Alzheimer's, it's a much more diffuse problem. So you can't take out the entire brain. And it's really kind of it's a mixing problem.
You got to find it.
Yeah.
You got to find what the problem is.
Yeah.
And look for it.
Exactly. But then the subsequent question is, what are you going to do with that information? And so right now, there are not a lot of things that you would put a needle into in the world of dementia or even this, with concussion, that you would change your therapy as a result of that biopsy necessarily. We don't have something that'll fix chronic traumatic encephalopathy, for instance.
Right. We have a caller here who has a question in connection with mental health and what have you. Kelly in Richmond Heights is going to join us. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, from the comments earlier, if I understood correctly, they were talking about how children naturally lose the neurons. And I was just wondering if any studies have been done, whether or not children with autism are not losing the neurons, causing possible neurological problems?
That is a good question. I know people have looked at functional connectivity, for instance, of kids with autism. And certainly I think that there is preliminary evidence that it is different from normal children. And now, whether that represents an increase or decrease in neurons, I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, and again, this is not exactly my field either, but I think what I've heard in the literature is that it's also a difference in the number of connections you have, not necessarily in the neurons.
That's right.
And, we're talking about a spectrum of diseases that have different genetic origins. So what's ultimately probably going to happen is there are going to be some diseases that are driven by neuron numbers changes, maybe others driven by connectivity number changes, right?
That's right.
So we'll have to see.
While we're talking about young people and going back to that again, we've had some discussions on this program about the penal system and putting young people who are incarcerated into solitary confinement, teenagers, and this creates a particular hardship on the young brain. Does that make any sense to you?
I think it's a particular hardship on any brain.
Yeah, I would agree.
This actually strikes to a theme of our original. Dr. Kim and I wrote a play, Brainworks, a while back, and we're getting ready to do our second. But fundamentally, you know, just as the brain is connected, and that's what really defines the complexity of the brain and its ability to do the wonderful things that it does. But it doesn't stop with just the brain. The brain needs to be connected to other brains, and people need to be connected. We're all fundamentally social creatures, and if we lack that interaction, I think it is damaging to our brains.
I agree. But I would say there are some caveats to that, and I know Eric knows about these. There's, for instance, a famous child psychologist, Jerome Kagan, who talks about basically there are not very many practices that parents do to their kids that gives you a predictable outcome. You know, if I do A, I'm not going to have a good child that, you know, will show me B. Yeah. And so he, a lot of his career was
spent. Is this the guy from Harvard?
Yeah.
We disagree on him. Yeah. So
no.
Good.
So I mean, you know, it's yet to be proven whether any one practice is going to give you a predictable outcome. Because it depends how the kid sees the thing. Also.
Although, but if you, you know, I think there is a pretty good, you know, example where, for instance, the Eastern Bloc orphanages where kids were not touched for the first couple years of their lives.
I would agree with
that.
They were functionally
devastated.
Absolutely.
You know, there is a fundamental need to have a connection that leads to kind of neuronal development.
I mean, I'm not advocating flowers in the attic, dungeon, no light kind of parenting here at all, you know, but I just don't know exactly if we know the outcomes of the parenting we do.
I think that's correct.
There was a stories years ago when there were all this concern about crack babies, and they found the most effective therapy for these children was to just hold them. That was the that worked better than anything else.
I can totally understand that. Yeah.
Not much time left. I wanted to bring the issue of sleep into the discussion here. What's going on with our brain? Is it being rejuvenated? Is that what's going on, and that's why we sleep, or do we know?
So there are a number of theories. One is that it ranges from being, it's dark at night, we don't want to fall off a cliff as a reason for sleep. I've heard that.
But there's clearly
two other things, yeah.
There's a detoxification function.
For sure.
And an information integration.
There's definitely evidence for that.
You know, we actually published not too long ago, there's a very interesting relationship between the memory organ in the brain called the hippocampus and cortex between wakefulness and sleep. So, for instance, when you're awake, there's a dynamic interaction where your cortex, the surface of your brain, is sending information into your hippocampus. But that direction of information flips when you're asleep, and it's actually going from your hippocampus to your cortex when you sleep. So it's integrating and embedding that information.
So people have looked at this in rodents. Basically, they'll put rodents through a maze, and they'll look at to see that part of them in the hippocampus, see how it fires, what sequence. And then when those rats or mice go to sleep, they'll basically play back that sequence as if they're going through the maze, but much more in a compressed time frame.
Yeah.
So you're sort of learning it again.
Where can folks find your podcast very quickly?
You can either you can get it through Brain Coffee at Barnes Jewish Hospital.
That's right.
I think that's probably the easiest way to do it, through Barnes Jewish Hospital.
We'll set up a link on our website at sdlpublicradio.org for people to have access to it.
Yeah, and I think the point is so that people can be part of this conversation.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I mean, we've all got one, supposedly, so we want to know more about it. Dr. Eric Luthart, thank you for being with us, and Dr. Albert Kim, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's great.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Alex Hoyer, Laura Hamden, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Char Dastin. Executive producer is Mary Edwards. Thank you for being with us. I'm Don Marsh.